Introduce Anjum Hajat. Anjum received her PhD in epidemiology from the University of North Carolina in 2010 and her master's in public health from the University of Michigan in 1998. Her research interests are in social epidemiology, specifically in the use of wealth as a measure of socioeconomic status in health research. In addition, Anjum is interested in better understanding the proposed stress pathways as a mechanism for how social factors cause disease. Currently, she is a postdoc fellow working on an ancillary study of MESA, the MESA Air Pollution Study, where she's investigating the interplay between social factors and air pollution as they impact cardiovascular disease.
Hi. So I should start by saying I'm not a statistician, so my talk will be much less technical than the previous two. I apologize, the title is incorrect in your in the abstracts and things in the book. So I'm going to talk today about using group-based trajectory models to analyze cortisol data. Okay, so we'll discuss the use of mixture models for analyzing repeated measure salivary cortisol data, and I'll show you an example. The motivating example here was to look at the association between cortisol and subclinical atherosclerosis. We'll talk specifically about the ankle brachial index. So I think we talked briefly about MESA. It's a big cardiovascular disease cohort. I won't spend much time. MESA stress, I think we also introduced to you. It's an ancillary study of the larger MESA, 1,000 participants with white, blacks, and Hispanics. And as you know, cortisol is a hormone related to stress. We did discuss some of this as well. And a good biomarker, it's thought, for the stress response. And I think you've seen this curve several times. So in our survey, the measurement was important in terms of the times that we measured cortisol. So we did it six times during the day, at wake up, 30 minutes afterwards, at 10 o'clock, at noon, around 6 p.m., and right before bed. And we had used a couple different methods to make sure that people were assessing or were taking their samples at the correct time. So we had about 1,000 participants, and each person collected six samples over 3 weekdays, so up to about 18 total samples per person, and that's clearly a hierarchical data structure. We have samples within days, within persons. We can have up to 18,036 salivary samples and 3,000 days. Of course, we didn't have that because we had some missing data, et cetera. So clearly lots of data in the MESA stress study, lots of salivary samples. So we were thinking about different ways that we could what different things we could do with this, and data reduction techniques may be helpful. So one thing we explored was a way to summarize the cortisol data, and we tried to use group-based trajectory models, or GBTM. So this method, I think, is primarily developed by Daniel Nagin, and there's a very good book, if anyone's ever interested in trying this at home, that's very easy to read and understand on the group-based methods. So basically, he says that these are trajectories that are designed to identify clusters of individuals that follow similar progression over time. And they make the point of saying that these trajectory groups are really approximations of a more complex reality. And I think what is meant by that in fact, if you were to go out into the population, you wouldn't see these discrete groups out there as the methods suggest. But really the purpose of the method is to complement the existing theory. So in the case of cortisol, we're very aware that clinically there's something called hypercortisolemia, it's Cushing's disease, or hypocortisolemia when you don't have enough cortisol, or Addison's disease. And that's been very well documented clinically. And similarly, in the epidemiologic literature, we see a lot of discussion about the cortisol profiles being high and flat or being low and flat. So the existing knowledge of cortisol sort of lends itself to this method. I think I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. We can talk about different alternative methods momentarily at the end. So the general form of the mixture model looks like this. It's relatively a simple, straightforward thing. So it's the probability of an unconditional, or the unconditional probability of observing individuals' eyes' longitudinal sequence of measurements. Y, obviously, in this course is in this case is cortisol. So the pi j, so j is the group, I is the individual, is the proportion of the population making up each group. So the features of the group-based trajectory models is that it's a likelihood estimation-based framework, which is nice because it lends itself to lots of different things that we can do with that. And the other nice feature of it is that you can adapt the general form of the model to whatever type of data that you have. So in our case, we're using more of a normal distribution, but you can, if you had count data or a Poisson distribution, you could use that, or if you had a binary outcome, you could use that as well. So it's flexible, which is nice. The one thing when you start off with trajectory groups is you have to specify a priori the number of groups that you think you're going to have in your population. So this decision is really based on substantive knowledge, what your data looks like, the extant literature. In addition, there are some statistical tools, some statistical criteria that may be helpful. I'll show you in our case it actually wasn't helpful, but in many cases it is. So we started off with a three-group model. As I said, because it has been pretty well documented that there's this, hyper versus hypocortisolemia, and then the bulk of people obviously have normal cortisol, and then we see the flatter and the steeper curves. There's also one paper out there that has used cortisol and these trajectory-based models, and they also have used a three-group model. In our case, the statistical criterion did not pan out for us. We used a Bayesian information criteria, but it wasn't able to identify the optimal number of groups. And this happens, it's actually sort of common, is what I was reading about. But in that case, you just really have to go with your substantive knowledge. So in this study, each individual was assigned to a group for each of the days of their non-missing data. So each person could have up to three, because we had 3 days of data collection, groups assigned to them. So this is what the results sort of look like. So you can see from the slide that we have a lower group here. This is sort of the low cortisol group in red, and that's about 7% of the total population. We have a normal group, which you would expect to be a larger percentage, about 81%, and then a higher, flatter cortisol group, which is about 11%. So these percentages down here are the pies from the earlier slide that I showed you, the pie J's. So we also tested, I should note, several other groups, several other models, a four-base model, a four-group model, a five-group model, et cetera. And this is sort of something that they recommend in the literature to do to try to assess if the one that you end up deciding is the best one for you. So just a couple adequacy diagnostics I wanted to go through. These are helpful, again, if you're going to try ever to use this methodology. The first one is called the average posterior probability. So what's interesting about this method is that it also gives you, in addition to assigning everyone to a group, a posterior probability. And this is the probability that an individual belongs to a specific trajectory group. So, for example, what happens for each individual, for each day in our case, in the data set, somebody gets a probability. So it'll say something like, you have a 90% probability that this person belongs to group one. But there's also potentially a 5% probability that they belong to group two or group three, for example. Obviously, ideally, you want everyone to have a probability of one, but that's not always possible, given that, you know, there's something potentially in their profile that in the data that's suggesting that maybe they could also be a very small probability, but maybe they could also be in group two or group three. So this statistics helps you sort of figure out, are we doing well in terms of does the model fit the data well? So what we found is it does. So 86% of the people, or the days, were correctly classified into group 1, 95% for group 2, which is our majority group, and 87% for group 3. So there is some room. So group 2 only had 5% misclassification. The other two groups had slightly more. But the author of the method, Daniel Nagin, recommends 0.7. So 70% indicates a good fit. So we definitely had a good fit. The next method, model adequacy diagnostic I looked at was the odds of correct classification. So this is similar to what I just showed you, except it's an odds. So in this case, it's an odds of 5 or higher is considered good assignment. So we did have a little bit of problems with our group 2, which was close, but not exactly at a 5, as the cutoff, recommended cutoff. And then doing some simple things like looking at confidence intervals around your pi statistic, we also did. And these were, you know, just to assess precision, et cetera. So again, to sort of apply this to our motivating example, we were interested in looking at the association between cortisol and subclinical arteriosclerosis. We looked at the ankle-breakle index, which is an indicator of peripheral artery disease, narrowing of the arteries in the arms and legs, causes stroke, heart attack, et cetera. So in the literature, it's usually dichotomized. Less than 1.1 is considered a high risk for peripheral artery disease, and between 1.1 and 1.4 is considered normal. So we looked at the three groups that we came up with, which I'm reminding you over here is what we found, in terms of a variety of clinical and demographic characteristics. And so what we found is the high cortisol group, so that's in blue here, also had more days of the ankylobrachial index and more coronary artery calcium, which I haven't shown you here. There's a larger percentage of blacks, as well as older age groups, and also more hypertension. And the low cortisol profile, we saw more Hispanics, more women, larger percentage with, less with obesity. And there was no statistical difference in some of the clinical measures or demographic features we looked at: education, wealth, diabetes, and smoking. Oops, I went the wrong way. So we also then applied a multivariate modeling approach to look to see if there was an association between cortisol and ABI. So we used ABI as a dichotomous outcome. And just for example's sake, I summarized the trajectory groups over our 3 days of data collection to sort of keep the example relatively simple. And then we had a minimally adjusted model, which we controlled for age, race, and sex, and then a fully adjusted model where we controlled for a host of other covariates that we think are associated with both cortisol and ABI. So the referent group here is our normal group, so that's that majority group. So we're comparing both the low and the high cortisol group to normal. So what we see here is that there is some suggestion, although weak and not statistically significant, that the high cortisol group has a higher odds of having prevalence of peripheral artery disease. After we adjust for all the covariates, it's about a 52% or so greater. Well, it's 0.5, it's the odds, right? So, but again, not statistically significant. And we don't see a lot here in terms of the low cortisol group. The confidence limits are pretty wide here. So in conclusion, we see in our bivariate results a stronger profile for the high cortisol group and a weak association between the high cortisol group and ABI in our multivariate model. But it is in the expected direction. Those with higher cortisol profiles have a 52% higher odds of being at high risk for peripheral artery disease. So the use of our three-group model was not confirmed with the statistical test, the Bayesian information criteria. However, given sort of existing knowledge of the three-group model, it did seem like a logical choice. And as I indicated before, we did try different groups, but it didn't actually work out well with our data given the sample size got sort of too small for some of them. We did find that the group-based trajectory models were advantageous because the groups, the participants, sort of into patterns of more clinical interpretation. So as I indicated, clinically we see sort of this high and low cortisol, and sort of that is also what we're seeing when we use this group-based modeling. We did see stronger and sort of more specific results when we use the piecewise model, and I briefly discussed the piecewise model before, and sort of you can figure out at what portions of the day you're seeing change, and that we were able to see with the piecewise model that we didn't see here. And one possibility is that these trajectories may sort of oversimplify the patterns that we're seeing in the data. And it's very limited in terms of who else has used this with cortisol. There's only sort of one paper that I could find. So I think it would be really interesting to look at this with other cortisol cohorts or data sets to see if we're able to see sort of similar patterns. And here are some resources for you if you're interested. That's it. Right, the odds were not. Yeah, and that is it's a little bit funny how that works. And I think what that's a function of is it's sort of how it works you know, and there's a pretty good explanation of this in the book, and I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but there was a good explanation for why this happened. It is a little odd, but I'm going to have to, let me get back to you on that. On this graph?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is smoothed. Well, it's 18, so 18 over 3 days. So this is sort of 1 day worth of data points. So it's 6 samples per day. So you're right, it is 6 per day. And then every person gets up to 3 days worth of data collection. Has up to 3 days worth of data.
How do you collect those 18 data points into 1 day worth of data?
So each day we collect 6 samples at various times during the day, and the next day they wake up and do the same 6 samples. So total there are 18 samples for each individual, but every day there are only 6. Did I answer your question?
You're talking about these measures were taken at the same time every day?
Correct, yeah. You're supposed to technically, not the same exact time every day. As soon as you wake up in the morning, you take a sample, then you take one 30 minutes later, you take one 10 o'clock, at noon, at 6, and then right before bed. So day one, maybe you wake up at 7 and you take it, but day two, let's say you wake up at 7:30, so you take it at 7:30. So it's not the same exact time, but the protocol is the same, meaning you always take it when you wake up.
Mm-hmm. So each person has 18 data points in your analysis?
Correct.